Episode 8, The Second Hidden Lesson of School, The Silencing of the Self. Critical Thinking Question. Consider for a moment the amazing and wonderful diversity of human beings in thought, ambition, imagination, and creativity. Why would some want to reduce so many unique individuals to a point where they can easily fit into a generally uniform and homogeneous group? If that question is too much of an earful, try this one instead. Imagine the advantages of having your very own robot army.
To begin to grasp the extent of the social experiment standing behind the visible structures of mass compulsion schooling, it isn't necessary to conjure up conspiracies of the classical variety, but only to look at child rearing from an engineering point of view, as animal training beyond the reach of the animal to fully comprehend, as when a falconer shrouds his bird to prevent it from obeying its nature, or when a horse racing association dictates that lead be attached to a fast horse's saddle to bring its performance in line with the rest of the pack. In both cases, bird and horse are less than they would have been, having been reduced to instruments of a different species design. With schooling, too, it shouldn't be difficult to understand that from certain perspectives, it might also be desirable to alter the behavior of human children negatively in the interests of some managerial goal.
Hey, Maddie.
Yeah, Tim?
Have you talked to Mark lately?
I haven't really talked to him, but he looks pretty down.
Yeah, he looks pretty down. Maybe we should cheer him up then.
What do you suppose we should do?
Well, does he like butter tarts?
I was lying on the grass of Sunday morning of last week,
indulging in my self-defeat.
My mind was thugged all lace and bug, all twisted.
When I was just a little boy, there was a television program that I found very enjoyable. And as I got older and my enjoyment in this program diminished, I found that my fascination with it was increasing. Reflecting back now, I've come to believe that this program, which was a Saturday morning cartoon, was actually a very clever and haunting metaphor for the American society that I was growing up in. The show was called The Smurfs. And if you never had the pleasure of watching The Smurfs, I can assure you that you didn't miss out on too much as far as entertainment value is concerned. But you did miss some very interesting and, like I said, very haunting parallels between their society and ours. Now, I'm sure at this point there is somebody saying, boy, I understood the Matrix reference, I reluctantly tolerated the Star Wars reference, but I really have a feeling that this guy is about to tax the limits of my imagination with the Smurfs here, but I encourage you to bear with me. For those of you who are completely unfamiliar with the Smurfs, they were these little blue creatures who wore white hats and white pants. They stood, by their own accounts, 3 apples tall, and lived in a mystical forest, making their homes underneath mushrooms. As we all know, the mushroom is a fungi which fares best when it is kept in the dark and fed manure, and these guys lived underneath them, so play around with that one for a minute. Nearly all of the Smurfs are helpless and dependent participants in a patriarchal society run by Papa Smurf, fittingly enough, who looks almost identical to Karl Marx, but I'm sure that that's just a coincidence. The Smurf village does have a library, but unfortunately for all of the other Smurfs, Papa Smurf is the only one who is allowed inside of it. The only other Smurf who is ever seen in the library is Papa Smurf's daughter-slash-concubine, Smurfette, but that's an element of the plot that we're not even going to explore here. Anyway, Because nobody is granted access to the library, it is pretty safe to infer that all of the Smurfs are illiterate. Because of this, they are pretty much entirely dependent on the supposed wisdom of Papa Smurf for all of their knowledge, which eliminates the possibility of original Smurf thought completely. Because of this deliberate dumbing down of the Smurf population by the ostensibly benevolent dictator, Papa Smurf, he is able to convince the other Smurfs that he is capable of magic. In fact, he stores, in the safety of the library, several books of magic spells. And when he attempts to execute these magic spells, they almost invariably fail. But, fortunately for Papa Smurf, the rest of the Smurfs are such complete friggin' idiots that they actually believe his magical powers are real, furthering his legitimacy as their ruler. Perhaps the most fascinating element of the show is the internal dynamics of the Smurf society. The highest value within the society appears to be uniformity. In fact, when any Smurf does show a departure from the others, in terms of personality, they are promptly given a nickname designed to alert the other members of the Smurf community about their nonconformist behavior. That being said, it's also interesting to point out that only one member of the entire Smurf community appears to have any education at all. This earns him the nickname Brainy Smurf, and he is the most despised and reviled Smurf of all. Most Smurfs find Brainy's intermittent injections of knowledge into their inane and empty conversations to be annoying. Brainy was also considered an outcast, because he didn't seem to speak the same dialect that the rest of the Smurfs spoke. Their language was incredibly simplistic, and for some reason, they were able to substitute the word Smurf for really any noun or verb that they wanted. And this either seemed to make sense to them, or they just didn't care that it made no sense at all. That was Smurf society. A place where the continuous suppression of individual thought was essential for propping up a poorly conceived authoritarian and anti-intellectual community. Now, why did I lose interest in the Smurfs? Certainly there was plenty of fun and adventure and bright colors, all the things that attract children to a television show. But even as an 8-year-old boy, I eventually found the Smurfs to be so damn predictable that it just wasn't enjoyable anymore. But this uniformity and predictability probably made life pretty easy for their ruler, Papa Smurf. If I remember correctly, the Smurfs aired from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. every Saturday morning. And in the event that you missed it one Saturday, you could pick up exactly the same message by attending public school 7 hours a day, Monday through Friday. The message that, to ensure the harmony of society, and for the convenience of those who rule it, great personal sacrifice is required. The self must be silent, and the individual non-existent.
Smurf along with me. Simple as can be.
Offices where people work are busy but quiet. And that is the way we keep our room. Because a quiet room helps all of us learn.
How do you do it?
Well, each of us knows how to work quietly. That's very important.
Will you show us?
Of course. Boys and girls, how would you like to show some of the ways we know of being quiet?
Yes!
Well, while we pretend to be working, who would like to show how we work quietly at our desk? Bobby?
Now, why is Bobby clearing his desk? Oh, now there won't be anything to fall off and make noise. You keep on your desk only things you need. That's part of keeping the room quiet. Uh-oh, the point broke. He'll have to sharpen the pencil. Can he move quietly so he doesn't disturb anyone? Do you think you could walk this quietly? Listen to this work sound. When he turns it slowly, it doesn't bother anyone. Work sounds tell that you're busy. They don't disturb others. But June seems to have lost something. Look, an eraser. Whose do you think it is? Bobby won't talk to June, will he?
June's the eraser. Yes, thank you. You're welcome.
Oh, whispering is the quiet way to talk when you have to talk. Well, Bobby has moved about quite a bit without disturbing the class. Could you do all that as quietly as Bobby did?
And you know, we have found that knowing when to be quiet is a part of growing up.
La 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 la, la. Now you know the tune.
You talk to any ruler, really at just about any given point in history, they'll tell you pretty much the same thing about human beings. They'll tell you that human beings are dangerous and irrational. And of course, by that they mean that these human beings, these confused creatures, will often act in their own best interest, instead of the best interests of those who are trying to exercise power and control over their lives. And that's a really inconvenient thing. And even a very thorough training in compliance and obedience is sometimes just not enough to ensure the continued status quo that those in power find desirable. So new lessons have to be added on top of obedience. The second lesson, built upon that foundational lesson, is conformity. Conformity plus obedience, you say? And yes, absolutely. Because even when one of these kooky human beings is generally obedient and well-behaved by the standards set down by the leadership, there's still the possibility that they might develop some of their own independent thoughts. And gosh, who knows where that's going to lead? So it's very important to nip this threat in the bud, to make sure that people, even if they do have those nonconformist thoughts, that they never verbalize them, that they never act on them. I mean, people can think whatever they want, but if they say what they're thinking, or if they try to act on what they're thinking, that's what needs to be avoided to maintain this desirable status quo. That's where conformity comes in. Now, when you combine conformity with obedience, for most people, this is something that you never have to worry about, because they don't even get to the point of thinking the thoughts. But you're always going to have those people who just don't want to go along with the plan. The authoritarian sociopaths and court intellectual types who really, really like the way things are right now, who really, really have just devoted their intelligence and energy to maintaining the status quo, they would know exactly what I was talking about. And I understand that that's not really my demographic, but in case anybody who fits those descriptions is listening, let me talk to them for a minute. Hello there. Authoritarian sociopath or shadowy intellectual elitist central planner. You guys know the kind of person that I mean. The kind of person who's like, I like to come up with my own ideas. I'm not so sure that the Earth is a flat plane that the entire universe revolves around. I think the scientific method is a better way to come to conclusions than ancient mysticism. I'm not so sure that slavery is the best thing to base an economy on. I don't think that violence is the best way for a society to run. The troublemakers. Those people are a pain in the ass. They want to change everything that is so good now, whenever now is, if you're in the seat of power. All right, now I'm done talking to the authoritarian sociopaths. But if they're out there, they know what I'm talking about. So this conformity training is certainly not unique to public education, and it's not a modern development. I think I summed up history before as a long story that just plays over and over again in a continuous loop about how a very small group of people controls a very large group of people by fear or by force, and conformity, along with obedience, is essential for achieving that goal. If people are going to be manageable, they need to be very predictable. Now, at the beginning of today's show, I played a clip by Jonathan Taylor Gatto, who I've mentioned a couple of times in recent episodes. And he encouraged us not to think about this compulsory schooling development in America as like a conspiracy. It's not that simple, and I worry that when I listened to a couple of past episodes of School Sucks podcast, that I might be encouraging some listeners to make up this visual in their head of John Dewey and Horace Mann and Woodrow Wilson and Alexander Inglis sort of sitting around this table in a smoke-filled room planning how to make American children in the 20th century dumb and shockingly similar to one another. But it's really just not that simple. The history is complicated. Public education has been pulled in a variety of different directions by a variety of different interest groups over time. But the initial system, as it was formulated in Prussia, was to make what the government considered to be good citizens and good soldiers. When it came to America, it also had a religious purpose, and then, eventually, after the Industrial Revolution, the purpose of making good, reliable, and predictable factory workers. Now, whether we're talking about the military, about religion, or about industrial labor, it's all about conformity. It's not about education. Never has been, never will be. Now, there was a real push for this conformity in the first two decades of the 20th century. In his book, For a New Liberty, Murray Rothbard talks about one example in his chapter on education. He writes, "The most ambitious attempt by the public school partisans to maximize their control over the nation's children came in Oregon during the early 1920s. The state of Oregon, unhappy with even allowing private schools certified by the state, passed a law on November 7, 1922, outlawing private schools and compelling all children to attend public school. Here was the culmination of the educationist dream. At last, all children were to be forced into the democratizing mold of uniform education by the state authorities. The law, happily, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1925. The public school fanatics never tried to go that far again, but it is instructive to realize what the forces were that attempted to outlaw all competing private education in the state of Oregon. For the spearheads of the law were not, as we might expect, liberal or progressive educators or intellectuals. The spearhead was the Ku Klux Klan, then strong in the northern states, which was eager to crush the Catholic parochial school system and to force all Catholic and immigrant children into the neo-Protestantizing and Americanizing force of the public school. The Klan, it is interesting to note, opined that such a law was necessary for the preservation of free institutions. It was well to ponder that the much vaunted progressive and democratic public school system had its most ardent supporters in the most bigoted byways of American life, among people anxious to stamp out diversity and variety in America." Now, this time that Rothbard is discussing in For a New Liberty was a very interesting period in American history, and it might be instructive for us to look at what was going on in some of the other areas of American society during those first two decades of the 20th century. An efficiency expert named Frederick Taylor was hard at work trying to find ways to turn human beings into more efficient pieces of machinery in the industrial process or in mass production. Public relations pioneer Edward Bernays was, as he might put it, trying to tap into the irrational and unconscious desires of the human animal in order to form them into a more predictable and manageable herd for the convenience of the political leaders he was working for. And in the schools, it was people like Alexander Inglis who had exactly the same goals in mind. We talked about what Inglis saw as the six functions of compulsory schooling. The second function he called the integrating function. Inglis writes, "The imperative demands made by society on the secondary school is provision for the development of that amount of like-mindedness, of unity in thought, habits, ideals, and standards, requisite for social cohesion and social solidarity. From this arises the integrating function of secondary education, which in this country particularly is constantly acquiring greater and greater importance for a number of reasons. Among these may be mentioned the following. 1, the increasing complexity of a modern democracy constantly increases the amount of common knowledge, of common action, and of common ideals necessary. The elementary school is constantly becoming less and less adequate for this need. 2, the increasing heterogeneity of the population in this country tends constantly to increase the diversity of social heredity and therefore to render the process of social integration more necessary and more difficult. 3, the increasing diversity of industrial occupations and of living conditions tends to constantly increase the forces of differentiation, demanding increased forces of integration to balance and compensate. 4, other institutions which formerly operated as integrating agencies have been modified in such a way as to operate with diminished force in that direction or have proved quite inadequate for that purpose under the changed conditions of society. For example, the church and religion." It's also worth mentioning that Inglis conceived the integrating function with the next piece of these six functions, which he called the differentiating function. Very quickly, he wrote, "The integrating function must at all times be conceived as correlated with the differentiating function of secondary education, and the relation between the two functions must be considered as supplemental rather than conflicting, the supplemental relation being necessitated by the relation of the two factors of integration and differentiation in the process of social evolution." Social evolution. That sounds like kind of a big project for one guy to plan. Guy writing a book. "As the integrating function of secondary education arises out of the necessity of developing a certain amount of homogeneity out of the heterogeneous population for the purpose of assuring social solidarity, so the differentiating function of secondary education arises out of the necessity of taking advantages of the differences among individuals for the purpose of determining social efficiency." And if you want to put just a little bit of icing on this cake, let me bring back John Dewey's quote, who said that you can't make socialists out of individualists. Children who know how to think for themselves spoil the collective harmony of society. What's interesting is how the goals, the agenda, the desires, and the plans of people like Horace Mann, John Dewey, and Alexander Inglis, just to name a few, are echoed today, even right up to today in 2009. By people who have had this system imposed on them. Regardless of what kind of arguments I make against the public education system, regardless of what kind of evidence I can find to substantiate those arguments, people, a lot of people, don't want to hear what I have to say. Probably because they're heavily involved, if they're, you know, a property owner, in the process of funding the system and its continued growth, of course. And they might even be marching their own children into it Monday through Friday. But what people are good at, as I mentioned before, is rationalizations. When you make arguments against something like public education, you'll quickly be interrupted and the rationalization machine will be turned on. The people will say school provides socialization, which is, of course, a euphemism for indoctrination and standardization. But they reframe it in a positive way, right? Like kids learn how to be social in school. And it's good stuff, right? The socialization that we learn in school. Like, how to fit ourselves into a clique where everybody looks and behaves almost identically. And at the same time, how to be antagonistic towards people who look differently or act differently. And, you know, most importantly, how to never do or say anything that causes us to stick out. Socialization. And if parents believe that there's something magical about the milieu of public education, the format, the schedule, the routines, that gives their children this socialization by osmosis. I have a suggestion for them, too. Get your kids into a prison. For, you know, you probably don't even need 12 years in prison, because it's even more social than school. An even bigger, stale, concrete building, with even more unwilling people packed into it and forced to interact with each other. And, yeah, you get free food in both places, there's activities, and maybe even some learning goes on. And both places have cliques. You'll really want to join a clique. In both situations, it is imperative to get yourself into a clique. If you don't get yourself into a clique, you're screwed. Now, in school, it's more of like being screwed in a social sense. Well, in prison, you're looking at more of a anal rape situation. But after a child goes through maybe those initial 9 years of conformity training, of learning how important it is to fit in to a homogenous group, I'm not sure how different the two would feel to somebody entering high school who has to deal with that much pressure about conformity. And they've been well trained in elementary school and middle school. So, just a suggestion for those parents who like to send their kids to school and support their schools for all of the socializing benefits, check out prison. There's plenty of them. They're always building more. And just as it is in any society, slowly but steadily marching towards totalitarianism, the admissions process, as far as prisons are concerned, always seems to be getting easier and easier. In the second part of this episode, we'll talk a little bit more about how this conformity training scales up to the adult society. Like, in other words, how does being trained to sort of seamlessly integrate yourself into a manageable and predictable group lead to people getting murdered and robbed in a socially acceptable way, what some people call politics? We'll also talk about some of the other ways that conformity shows up in the adult world. And when we do that, it will really reveal the ultimate purpose behind compulsory education or government school. Because we've seen how a lot of different groups have lined up to use the force of the state to their own benefit. Religious, industrial, the Ku Klux Klan. And even today, in the modern corporate structure, most people are bees in a hive. They're not asked to think for themselves. They're not asked to develop individual and original ideas. They are asked to fit themselves into a machine, into a box, into a cubicle. But the ultimate purpose behind this conformity is, see, in society, it's okay if people have minor disagreements over healthcare, over who should be able to get married, over abortion. It's fine, as long as they all conform to the idea that violence is how problems get solved. Violence by strangers who know how to manage your life better than you do. That certain people get certain privileges. That certain people have the right to initiate force against others. As long as the great majority of people will continue to believe that idea, they can disagree about whatever little insignificant things they want. And those disagreements lead to little subdivisions of new predictable groups. Politicians absolutely love that, because then they can travel around and target specific messages to that predictable group. They know exactly what to say. They know exactly what the group cares about. The group even names itself something that makes it so easy for the politicians to do this. And if the rulers are really lucky, these smaller groups will even start to fight each other, something that the rulers find, at least as far back as the days of the Roman circus, completely amusing. Thanks for listening. We will pick up this topic again soon in a second part of this episode on conformity. Until then, take care.
I know it's done for me.